It's a great pleasure to be here. And as I did this morning, some of us did take a walk around these absolutely extraordinary gardens and get a sense of the beauty of this place. What I thought I would do is ask Professor Gawat to talk for about 10 minutes and then ask David Aronovich to comment on that, and then we'll have a conversation, and then I hope that you will have some questions, and so I will ask you to be thinking about questions while the speakers are speaking, because I think it would be very good to have some audience participation. I think we're very lucky to have two such skilled and experienced commentators who can both talk about the history and the context of the rise of nationalism across Europe today, and also talk about the contemporary scene. And I think there are worrying signs, perhaps we get too worried, but there seem to be worrying signs that there is a growth of a radical right-wing populist nationalism which is intolerant of others. And I think it will help to get some perspective on that, to hear from Professor Gawat and from Mr. Aronovich, have we been here before? And so I'm going to ask you, Robert, if I may call you Robert, to talk for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll take some comments and questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Margaret. The topic of the panel is whether we're currently seeing a return to right-wing politics or extreme politics like we did in the late 1920s and early 1930s in response to another economic crisis, the Great Depression. And I think the short answer to that is probably yes and no. What we are seeing are certain echoes of the 1930s, in my personal opinion. There are certain parallel developments. The first one, I would suggest, is that we see the erosion of what we might call the post-war consensus, something that we also saw in the 1930s. So what I mean by that is that the notion that European stability and democracy depends on international cooperation, that sentiment was very strong both in 1918 and again after 1945, when people believed that they should do everything in their power to prevent a return to the past. And post-1945, this consensus was promoted by centre-left and centre-right political parties throughout the European continent, usually social democrats and conservatives, and indeed as a direct response to the horrors that Europe had witnessed over the previous years. It was carried by politicians who had either fought in that war or who had suffered directly. We think, for example, of people like Adenauer, de Gaulle. We think of politicians in subsequent decades like Helmut Kohl, who had lost his father in the Second World War, for whom the Second World War remained the central historical reference point. At the moment, what we're seeing is perhaps a move away from that consensus. For many people, the Second World War is no more than a distant memory. And many people have forgotten how horrible wars are because they are no longer part of the European experience. That is one aspect. Obviously, the rise of the political right and the extreme political left are a direct result of the toxic combination of the most prolonged economic crisis in European history since the Great Depression, and simultaneously the worst refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War. In addition, you also have this palpable anti-establishment moment, which has prompted dissatisfaction with, if not outright, rejection of established political parties, precisely those political parties that upheld what are called the post-war consensus until quite recently. As a consequence, we are seeing a radicalization of political politics, both on the left and on the political right. This is not only true for Europe, but also for the United States, where Donald Trump is a very real possibility as the next American president. In Europe, the examples are plentiful and perhaps too obvious to mention, but they range from UKIP to the Alternative für Deutschland in Germany, Poland's ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party, to Viktor Orban in Hungary, Golden Dawn in Greece. So you can continue that list. It is becoming longer and longer. It is also the case that Norbert Hofer is a likely candidate to become president in Austria. And it is indeed also a possibility that the next French president will be Marine Le Pen. Something that was unthinkable a couple of years ago. And I don't want to sound too alarmist, but at the same time, the crumbling of the post-war consensus also means that the political parties in the past have always used a certain tool. They have tended to ignore the right. So by not talking to them at all, by banning them from television, they have successfully managed to suppress them. This is no longer working, that trick. In fact, it fires up conspiracy theories, just like the ones that flourished in the 1920s and 30s, that the political establishment and the collaborationist media is suppressing the true voice of the people, which in turn brings them more and more votes, as we see in various elections across Europe. Around a decade ago, the Columbia University historian and fascism expert Robert Paxton rightly pointed out how a fascism of the future, an emergency response to some still unimagined crisis, would not resemble classical fascism perfectly in its outward signs and symbols. The enemy would not necessarily be the Jews. Instead, Paxton argued that an authentically popular fascism would be pious, anti-black, and since September 11th, also anti-Islamic as well. In Western Europe, it would be secular, and these days more likely anti-Islamic than anti-Semitic. 10 years on, I think this prediction actually sounds eerily familiar and rings very true. It would be wrong to assume that right-wing extremism of the future or the present would take exactly the same shape of the 1930s. I don't think that we will see another Hitler movement precisely because the Second World War and the Holocaust happened. And people may not have a very strong historical memory, but they certainly remembered these two catastrophic events, interrelated events, and I cannot see a repeat of that particular aspect of the past coming again. At the same time, I think we should be concerned that the far-right parties will develop a more modern form of right-wing populism, which will appear precisely because it is not the same as Nazism, because it is not overtly anti-Semitic, but appeals to other lower popular instincts. What we already see, and here again I think we have an echo of the late 1920s and 1930s, is that the established political parties, centre-left, centre-right, are starting to panic because of the existence of extremist political parties. They are now beginning to impact on their own political agenda, which is quite remarkable. So if we take the case of Germany, for example, the rise and continuing rise of the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, has put Chancellor Angela Merkel into a very tight corner, with more and more politicians from her own political party demanding that she changes her stance on immigration. Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, said that the very existence of the AfD is the key reason why Berlin must hold the line on austerity politics, making necessary Eurozone integration look a more distant prospect than ever. The same is happening very much in France, where the growth of the Front National is impacting on the political agendas of the mainstream political parties, who try everything they can in order to avoid a Le Pen election victory, and therefore adopt parts of the more extreme right-wing political agenda. So if these agendas that are proposed by these populist right-wing movements, if they are implemented, it seems very unlikely, and we're already seeing that, I think, in the debates in Britain, that free movement of Europeans will be part of the future, and that instead we will see a return or a reconstruction of sovereign nation-states, which may indeed lead to very similar issues and problems as we witnessed in the aftermath of the First World War, perhaps not quite as violent, and I don't think we will see a return to violent street rows between different political factions anytime soon. Yet, at the same time, the vision of building a United States of Europe, as articulated by Winston Churchill in response to the horrors of World War II, will become nothing but an obsolete memory of the past. And I think that the continent will then surely be less similar to Europe in, say, the 1950s, and much more similar to the Europe that emerged in the later 1920s and 1930s in response to the multifaceted crisis of those years.
Well, thank you for those very thoughtful and also very worrying remarks. I'm thinking, as you were talking, of another period which I think also shows similarities, and that's the period before 1914, when a lot of people were feeling the impact of globalization. And I think, as we're realizing today, not everybody wins by globalization. I mean, we probably all win as consumers because we get cheaper goods, but it means that jobs disappear, they go offshore, people are working two or three jobs, they don't see a future for themselves or their families. And I think you had that also before the First World War. Mm-hmm. And I think what also there was before the First World War, and I'm wondering if we're, I'd like just to get your thoughts on this, whether we have a real fear of the pace of change. I mean, the technological and societal change before 1914 was huge, and there was a lot of worry that the world was moving too fast. There was even fears that going on fast tube trains and driving in cars would do something strange to the human physiology. Hmm. Do you think we're seeing a reaction today? I mean, these enormous advances in science and artificial intelligence, which are calling into question the whole idea of what it is to be human and what are we going to look like as a human race. I'm just wondering whether you see any parallels between that pre-1914 period and what's happening today.
I would say so, in the sense that the world seems to be moving faster and faster, global interconnectivity through the internet and so on and so forth, the bombardment of people with information, but also, I think, very significant societal changes that are happening. Again, I wouldn't necessarily think, although historians are notoriously bad at predicting the future and should probably refrain from it, but I would say that an inner European war of the kind that we witnessed after 1914 or after 1939 is very unlikely. We will see different forms of conflict within societies. We see that armed conflict is changing dramatically in the form of asymmetrical wars, the rise of terrorism. So the idea that we would have a repeat of the industrial battles of the 20th century is probably would be absolutely awful, of course, but it's unlikely. But what we're seeing is perhaps a sort of an escalation into chaos and a move away, a very regrettable move away from the remarkable stability and economic prosperity that all European societies have enjoyed since the end of the Second World War.
Yeah. And is there something, I mean, you were talking about the way in which we've forgotten collectively why we needed a united Europe, that as with the passage of time, it's bound to happen. We forget what Europe was like in 1945 after the Second World War. Is there something that political elites and leaders, I mean, how much is it a question of leadership can do to remind us all? And it struck me very much in the Brexit campaign, or the referendum campaign, I should say, that there wasn't a strong case made for remaining it put in historical terms. Mm. It was put very much in economic terms. I mean, do you see a role for the leadership here, or do you think elites are so discredited that no one's going to listen to them anyway?
Mm. Well, I was actually surprised how little the past featured in that debate, because, well, if I had been in charge of the Remain camp, I would have made that the central message, because I think that the European project, faulty as it may be in many aspects, is it makes sense in the historical context in which it happened or was started after the end of the Second World War, even though the ideas were already there after the end of the First World War, when some intellectuals pushed for ever closer European integration, precisely to avoid the clash of nation states over ethnicity or economic terms. Mm. I think that people have forgotten how horrible wars are. And I find that astonishing as someone who works a lot on wars. And wars for Europeans have become something distant that happens in ghastly places, or at least that's how we perceive them, where violence is endemic. What we need to remember is that for the first half of the 20th century, it was Europe that was the most violent place on earth, not Africa or the Balkans. It happened in the heart of Europe.
Yeah. We've had a rather discouraging picture of the present, and not a very encouraging picture of the past. David, what do you think of this picture? Would you take issue with any of it, or would you add something to it?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that it's a nice phrase to say, I don't want to be alarmist, and then conjure up the spectre of President Le Pen and President Trump. And if indeed we do get to 2017 and those are two realities, then I think I could be very alarmed indeed, really genuinely very alarmed indeed. So the first thing to say is, I think, that what we're really talking about probably is a populist phenomenon of a rejection at some level or another of whatever the settlement has been. We'll come back to how widespread that actually is, because we have a slight tendency to think 20% equals 100% if you've never had the 20% before. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back to that in the context of Germany in particular in a moment, because you touched upon the impact that an edge of people can have upon the mainstream, which seemed to me to be very interesting. Because we're not just talking about right-wing movements, we're also talking in some places about left-wing populist movements. The problem for left-wing populist movements is, by and large, the right-wing is better at populism than the left-wing. So they get a bit of traction amongst their own people, but actually, on the whole, left-wing populism has a tendency to increase, if you can, the level of populism overall to the advantage of the right-wing, which tends to have the better simplistic answers. Yeah. And also tends to rely on identity politics in a very big way, the sense that I have a grievance against them. And it really is interesting how much of the right-wing movement, and to a certain extent some of the left-wing populist movement, is based on the fantasy of separation. Mm-hmm. It's based on the idea somehow or other that if you can just separate yourself from all these kind of foreign influences or these people coming in or these multinational companies or all these people who've come in to kind of take you over and so on, then in that case you will be able to do things better for yourself once you kind of get rid of them. And the three elements of that, usually in a kind of right-wing and to a certain extent in a left-wing populist for framework, are nativism, much more true of right-wing populism, the idea that there is an identity within your own country which is sullied in some way by having these other people come in and alter it, etc., and it's under threat. Protectionism, very common both to the left and the right, that actually somehow or other you can alter the terms of international trade by restricting it to your benefit without somehow or other everybody else doing the same thing, so it's to their benefit, so actually it's to nobody's benefit. And isolationism, i.e. what business is it of ours what they do in X, Y, or Z, in the left-wing way of formulating, but to a certain extent in the right-wing populist under current circumstances, it is what is so much better about us because flawed as we are, that we should tell them what to do, no, it's better, or formulate another way, let them just get on with it and kill each other, which is another kind of version of that. During the Troubles here, there was a fragment of left-wing thought, and actually quite a large one, the Daily Mirror represented it, which was the Troops Out movement, with the idea that essentially the political appeal for it in England, Scotland, Wales was, let the Irish kill each other. That's what it was. But the left-wing people could actually adopt this on the basis that it was also about self-determination and so on. And these two things could kind of run together. So across Europe, you have some left-wing populist movements. You have a left-wing populist movement currently having taken over the Labour Party. I think almost certainly to the absolute disastrous end that party will discover in September and beyond. And this will come back to the caveat which we have about our alarmism in a moment, and then I'll stop. Podemos in Spain, which is actually not anything like as far left as the Corbynism is. People completely fail to understand how far out Corbynism actually is, and Corbyn actually is. He's become this sort of strange figure upon which people kind of attach their own politics without actually noticing what his are, which is really peculiar to somebody as old as me who's known what he is for 40 years and so on. You have Syriza, and then the splits within Syriza, because naturally after Syriza took over government in Greece, the left wing split off from it because the first thing that a government has to do is do sensible stuff. That's kind of too much for a lot of people. They always find a way of kind of saying, well, I don't want to be associated with all this compromise, etc., and off they went. And then you have right-wing populists, and we've talked about a very big range of them. Golden Dawn is not really quite what UKIP is. Mm-hmm. It is a very kind of different organisation in a way. UKIP is actually pretty much like the Front National in France, in its current incarnation, and so on. The AFD is a work in progress, it seems to me. We can talk about that in a moment, about what it is. It's a relatively new organisation in Germany, but I'll just want to, I'll end up with this kind of one kind of caveat for us to think about also. What's extraordinary, say, about Germany is that Germany decided to take in nearly a million refugees. This is an absolutely extraordinary thing to do. I think we've taken in 40,000, or maybe even fewer, fewer than that, and so on. It's a million people. In almost any other country in Europe, that would have meant a complete collapse of the political system. Yeah. What you have got is 20% of people voting for the AFD. Now, just one final point. My problem with the is if you look at where people say they are still in the political spectrum, in Britain and elsewhere, they identify with the centre, but they want the centre to offer something that works. Part of the problem with populism is it has no solutions, actually, to any of the problems. We're seeing it now in the Brexit thing, you know. Yeah. We're not going to give a running commentary on Brexit, i.e. we don't know what the hell we're going to do, which is how that translates down. Let's try and work something out. And in the meantime, let's not let you into the discussion about it because you might spoil it, which is what it amounts to. So it begins then to coalesce around symbolic measures, like the classic one is the banning of the burkini. You don't get a more classic symbolic measure. It does you no good. It alters nothing. Mm. It just makes people more pissed off, excuse my language, etc., without actually altering the background to anything whatsoever. And therefore, these sorts of measures, these sort of kind of cosmetic but nevertheless damaging measures, become the kinds of things that populist movements begin to cohere around, because actually they don't have any answers in the globalised world of the modern world of modern communication. Of modern trade.
Yeah. I would agree with you, and I think one of the great ironies is the people who are so against foreign influences will take out their Samsung phones, go and eat chicken tikka in the pub, expect to be able to enjoy all the benefits of globalization. But I'm wondering if there's somewhere here a failure of elites, that there has been an abdication of responsibility, or maybe elites are so discredited that no one will listen to them. But you know, where are the counter-arguments? I mean, we're not getting them, certainly from the Republicans in the United States, who are not saying, look, the United States' prosperity depends on being a trading nation, and we've always been an immigrant-receiving nation. I mean, the fact, I found it appalling that the United States I can understand it more in Europe, which hasn't had the degree of immigration, perhaps, that countries like my own Canada has had. But I find it appalling that in the United States there is this anti-immigrant feeling from, led by someone called Donald Trump. You know, his family were German. You know, but this irony seems to pass people by. I mean, the other thing I'm wondering if you could both comment on is how much of this anti-immigrant feeling is racist. You know, there's a lot of talk about how it's just they have different practices from us. But the fact that we describe people coming from Syria, from anywhere in the Middle East, from North Africa as Muslim, when in fact they may not be Muslim at all. They may be, you know, secular. But we don't choose to describe them as Syrians, Algerians, Moroccans. We tend to say the Muslim, as if this is somehow a racial category. I mean, do you think there's a racist element in all this? And also, can you both comment on the role of elites? Could they be doing more to counter some of these poisonous narratives? Robert, do you?
I think it's very difficult to counter them because politics is about emotion as much as it is about reason. So you have to appeal to the heart. I mean, returning to the points that you both made, I mean, the AFD, as you say, is work in progress. And I think there is a racist segment within that party somewhere. There are also people who are disgruntled, former CDU voters, former SPD voters, who are looking for a new political home, because the only government party that is against Merkel's policies is the CSU, which you can only vote for in Bavaria. So if you are anti-mass immigration and you live in Berlin, you have limited options and your natural party would be the AFD. Again, the discussion in Germany is quite complex because there are very few people who say we should not take in refugees. The debate at the moment is about whether the 1 million people who came last year alone are all refugees. I think even people in the CSU and some people in the AFD would say, if these are genuine refugees, if we get 300,000, or I think the CSU proposed 200,000 per year as the maximum, and that's a very conservative party, so they're saying 200,000 per year, as long as they are genuine refugees from Syria, but of course about 700,000 or so it is suggested in the discussion, are economic migrants, mainly from Africa. So I would say that 90% of the German electorate does not actually have an issue with the fact that refugees are coming. Germany is a wealthy country and it can afford to help. So I think in that respect it is very different from Golden Dawn.
It's very different from here. It's very different from the Conservative Party in Britain. Yeah. It's very different from the Labour Party in Britain. It's very different. I don't know how things are in Northern Ireland, how the discussion goes. I get the flavour from the cab driver from the airport and so on, and it didn't seem very different from the way it was in the rest of Britain either. Mm. I mean, there's no way you would have any party here say we will take 200,000 refugees wherever they came from. Yeah. They just wouldn't dare do it.
Yeah. And the irony is, just to interrupt you both, that in fact the skills and the labour of a lot of these people who are coming, whether they're economic migrants or refugees, are necessary. The National Health Service would not function without the skills being imported from
abroad. This goes back to the point about whether or not populist parties actually have an alternative to them. I mean, the big problem that we have, and this is where we'll play out in Brexit, as we know, in terms of whether or not there is a single market freedom of movement trade-off, is that actually significant levels of immigration have been very good economically for Britain. We can talk about the disruptions that are caused or seem to be caused to people, particularly disruptions in their notions of identity, which are not unimportant, but they are not essentially economic. And so it's like most of free trade and so on. The problem is that you pay an incredibly high penalty for stopping it, a penalty which those people who want to stop it are never prepared to acknowledge. Yeah. They will always try and tell you that there's somehow or other some advantage to you. I went up to Wakefield, which was one of the primary leave areas in the way in after the referendum, only to talk to people who'd voted for Leave. Now, amongst all voters, there's what we call cognitive dissonance. People will vote for something for a reason which they know actually, if they think about it, is kind of relatively impossible. I remember talking to one woman, very nice woman, from a mostly working class background. She had been very ill quite a lot. She'd spent a lot of time in hospital, cancer operations. And she said she couldn't speak too highly of the European and other migrant staff who are in the hospital, but she wanted their jobs to go to English people. She said English. She would have no attitude towards being in Britain, with Northern Ireland particularly, and so on, to English people. And it wasn't my job to argue with her, but I wanted to say to her, don't you think that there's a problem because these foreign people are actually able to do the jobs, and the English people, the kids you want to give the jobs, if they were up to it, they'd have them now because it would be easier. Yeah. So do you really want markedly less good cancer treatment than you were getting?
How much... I mean, it's driven by fear, I guess. But that doesn't mean people don't have reasonable concerns about what's happening in their lives. And again... I mean, this question of political leadership seems to me important. That maybe Germany has had better political leadership than some other countries. I mean, what Germany hasn't had are the sorts of scandals that Italy has had. You know, there was this great hope in Italy with the Clean Hands movement that things were going to improve, and things haven't improved. And the five-star mayor of Rome, for example, was elected after a huge series of scandals involving the previous mayor. So how on earth do societies rebuild that sort of trust and belief that those who run for office are in fact doing a public service? I mean, there's such contempt now for politicians, and we see this quite, they're all in it for themselves. Can this be rebuilt? It seems to me a toxic atmosphere.
It is absolutely toxic, and to be honest with you, I don't see a way out of the situation. I think the only reason why Merkel in Germany is still in power is because of the economic data. Germany is doing extremely well financially, economically. Otherwise, she has maneuvered herself into an impossible corner. There are state elections in Berlin, the capital today. Berlin is far more left liberal than the rest of the country, so I don't expect another 20% victory. But even 15% could be the end of her, because the CSU, her coalition partner, Bavarian coalition partner, is stepping up the pressure. And they refuse to support her in the next general election next year unless she completely changes her policies towards refugees. So even though, as you say, it's only 20% who voted for the AfD in the last state elections, there's a lot of pressure building up at the moment. So I think there is actually a fundamental political crisis about to happen.
No, that's very point very well made. I mean, when Nigel Farage stood up at the European Parliament after the referendum and said, essentially stuck two fingers up to everybody and said, see, 17 years ago I told you that we'd leave and you all laughed at me. Well, who's laughing now? And so on. Problem was, it was true. His tail had wagged the dog, and we've all gone had to go with it in the end. I mean, for one reason or another. So, and that mechanism partly did exist in that way, with right-wing Tories or anti-European Tories using the existence of UKIP and UKIP's strength to make the argument for a referendum, which actually even some of the pro-Brexit Tories hadn't wanted. Michael Gove famously did not want a referendum because he didn't want to be forced into that position, which is odd, but nevertheless, that's the way it was. That's true, and yet... You talked about the question of the elite. Part of any populist project is to project the notion of the out-of-touch elite, which takes decisions on your behalf, which isn't representative of you, and is out to feather its own nest. Yeah. One of the things that we should do is be very, very careful about embracing that language of the elites. I mean, who actually are the elites in that sense? Are we talking about professors? Are we talking about columnist for national newspaper? Are we talking about historians? Yeah, according to a lot of people, we are all part of this elite by the simple virtue that we think we know what we're talking about quite often, or we put ourselves in a kind of position of excellence. The fact that we're up on this platform and you're down there, that makes us the untrustworthy elite or unrepresentative of you, according to a lot of people. And that's virtually the head of the National Trust just said, here. So it kind of gives you an idea. So we have to be very careful of this, and yet we fall into it incredibly easily. To me, if I was to kind of map out a project, it is robust liberalism. It is to recommend to the population the virtues of liberalism and the liberal economy. There was, at the end of our session yesterday on Russia, a young man stood up and said, essentially, who are we to lecture the Russians about these things? And I thought, actually, what I want to say to you, and if this person was still here, I would say it now, did you value being able to stand up just now and say what you said?
Yeah.
Was it important to you to be able to do it? Because if it was important to you to be able to do it, that's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's there, illustrated right there. That's what we do here. That's what we do in liberal societies and so on. It underpins the things that we are. One of the reasons for the European Union's importance was not because it wasn't a flawed organisation. How can an organisation of 27 to 28 countries be otherwise than complicated and difficult? It was that it set itself up as an organisation which other people wanted to join, but in order to join, they had to subscribe to the liberal values which the EU has. And one of the problems we have in Eastern Europe now is that some of them are beginning to edge away and say, we think we can be members of the European Union, but kind of tear down some of these liberal values you've imposed. And the EU has to say to them, you can't.
Yeah. Mm.
You can't. If you're going to be like that in Hungary and so on, actually, with all the best men in the world, we may actually have to do something, take action against you.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Robert, do you want to comment before I throw it open?
Yeah, no, just one brief comment on something related that you said earlier on, because I think that's a very important point, the rise of the left, of the populist left. I mean, this is where we actually see a return of the 1930s, and it's actually quite dangerous, because what we see is the parallel rise of the extreme left and the extreme right, which eventually will channel the majority of votes towards the right in response to a real or perceived threat that the left will build another communist experiment. Mm. So the middle classes will then prefer to flock to the right, because they believe that they are the only ones with the necessary determination to stop the left-wing project.
Yeah.
So that would be a real return to the 1930s if that ever happened, because that's precisely what happened in Germany in the lead-up to 1933, where a lot of the supporters of the Nazi Party voted for Hitler because they felt that the alternative was a Stalinist state. A victory of the Communist Party.
Well, you had the same thing with the French right, who said rather Hitler on the Rhine than Stalin.
Mm.
I'd like to get some of your views. I don't know if any of you would like to ask a question. We have a gentleman here. We have someone there. I'll take this gentleman. Since you're there with the microphone, why don't I save you the walk, and we'll take this gentleman first, and then if you're all right, he can come up, bring the microphone up. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. You've highlighted the seeming ubiquitousness of this drift left and right. Is there an example that springs to mind where that liberal democracy has still been held high?
Canada. I hate to be patriotic, but Canada's not doing badly. Sorry, what did you?
That's true. Actually, Canada is definitely one country that a large country that springs to mind immediately.
We're all going.
Thanks.
I tell you, President Trump, President Le Pen, I'm off to Canada.
But I think on the European continent, we definitely see a common pattern, the erosion of the liberal consensus.
David, what?
Well, I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about is the growth of populist right-wing movements in places like the Netherlands, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, even in all these places. Now, one of the things I can't work out is whether or not they will essentially be called out sometime soon. In other words, whether it won't become apparent, or also whether they have the capacity in most of those places to break out of their 20% and so on. And when it becomes apparent, if it does, that they can't, then in that case, even some of the sort of centre-right organisations that have lent towards may create a sigh of relief. Obviously, the big underpinning question of all this is whether or not we do get any form of a long-term economic uplift, and what we do with that economic uplift, because that will change the circumstances, that feeling of kind of incredible corrosive pessimism. One of the things that's really interesting about something like a party like UKIP is its staggering pessimism about how we are. And you also find this populist on the left, combined with a sort of millenarian optimism about what you could suddenly do if only you changed one thing. So you get, you know, you'll get Corbynistas who say it's absolutely awful, everything's awful, nothing's any good, etc. But if Jeremy gets in, the whole place will be transformed. Well, if it's as bad as that, how could Jeremy getting in possibly transform anything? I don't believe it could. So you get this sort of strange now. Maybe it's a wrong hope and so on. I mean, but although liberals are slow, you know, I mean, the classic liberal position is, let's say, over Trump and Hillary Clinton. You see it all over now and again. It is clear that Trump is 1,000 times worse candidate than Hillary Clinton. By any objective measure, we could take you through them all, that he is... If you think that she is occasionally a bit dishonest in the way that politicians are, Trump is an absolute serial liar of the first regard. If he says black is black, then you know it is actually white at that moment, because otherwise he wouldn't be telling you this, and so on. I mean, this is no exaggeration at all. And yet, the liberal media and so on have to treat it as if there is some form of equivalence in some strange way, in order to try and be a little bit fair. And indeed gets to the point actually of saying, well, you know, Hillary's very unpopular, so maybe, you know, there's a problem, then we'd better examine, etc. And I've come across some of these things in the BBC itself. And one of the things that liberalism has got to get back to is being firmer about its values and about when those values are being upheld and when they're not, even if to some people it may seem a little bit kind of irritating, in order to make people feel the benefit of those values emotionally, rather than just that we're always having an argument about outcomes and figures and so on. In other words, we have to kind of inject that in, because otherwise, if we don't, then the other sides have all the passion. And it's important we reinvigorate the debate with our own passion.
And that it has, I mean, there have been times in the past where those who believe in constitutional government, however much they disagree about how it should be used, have come together. I mean, the Popular Front in France in the 1930s was an attempt to defend an existing order, and a very good case was made. I mean, I think it is important not to be defensive, and actually to point out, as you pointed out, or should have pointed out to the young man yesterday, that he was able to stand up and say what he wanted freely. Now, we have someone here who's going to stand up and say what he wants freely, so it's your turn.
Yes, a slightly different topic, but I just wanted to ask for your views on the role that the internet is playing in all of this. Obviously, it's been a huge technological development, which has enabled all sorts of new commercial developments. On the other hand, of course, it is a huge opportunity for people to rave and rant on the internet, on the social media, in a way that has never been available to people before, as anybody who's been on the wrong end of it knows to their cost. You know, it can be very vituperative.
What happened?
I just wonder to what extent is that process actually exciting intolerant political attitudes? And what do we do about that?
Very interesting question. Robert, do you want to tackle it first?
Yeah, I'm often horrified when I look at social media comments on newspaper articles or whatever, Facebook, and the sort of rise of hate speech, again, I think across Europe. I'm not sure whether this is just another form of expression of something that people always had on their minds, or whether this is a new phenomenon that, you know, you can comment on something with a relative anonymity of the internet. But quite often you will find
extraordinary things written by people who use their real names, which astonishes me. Attempts today to establish a certain voluntary etiquette of the internet have, I think, failed remarkably. But I'm not necessarily arguing for legislation to be introduced against it. Maybe it's just best to ignore the views of of certain people. Because very often, again, as I said early on, this has relatively little to do with rational arguments. It is impossible to convince someone who feels very strongly about certain issues and argues in a very emotional way to convince them by posting a counter-argument. So you may as well not bother.
David, do you want to comment quickly?
The internet is as big a change in our way of thinking about ourselves as the Industrial Revolution was. I always remember a column by Simon Jenkins once, who's a rival of mine, when he said that the internet was nothing new. It was, you know, so beautifully wrong.
Did you send him a rude email?
No. The thing about Simon is that by the next year he'd forgotten that he'd said that the previous year. It was a kind of, you know, there are columnists with memories and columnists without. It's fundamentally changed everything. So I don't think the most important thing about the internet, I don't think, is the way in which it conducts debate. That is important. I think it's about how it alters the notion of self in relation to politics and indeed to consumption. I really do. I think, in a way, it's summed up by the phenomenon of the selfie, you know, where you'd be people take endless pictures of themselves. Now, my generation did not take pictures of themselves. You couldn't. You know, there were some very expensive pieces of kit which allow you to do a self-timer, etc. But otherwise, there are a few people might have taken photographs of themselves in the mirror if the lighting was good. We just didn't do it. And now we have the kind of endless phenomenon of the selfie with this as a background, the selfie with that as a background. In a way, we think about ourselves in relation to politics and to everything else in relation to our kind of identification with it. You know, where are we? What do we sign up to? On Twitter, you can add something called a twibbon, which is a ribbon which says what your affiliation is. So all the people who vote Corbyn, it's not just Corbyn, but a large amount, put "I voted Corbyn" on underneath their photographs themselves, their avatars and so on. This doesn't actually oblige them to do anything else or think about anything or turn up to anything or anything else. It is just becomes a mark of self-identification in the context of the new political world. This is creating entire virtual movements of people who also have votes, by the way. They vote. All these tens of thousands of people who join the Labour Party simply to make a vote are essentially selfies of one kind. And it really is altering some bits of politics amongst younger voters. There are also some very positive elements of this which we could go into. Yeah. And I think that's more important, possibly, in the end, even than what we call the kind of trolling phenomenon, which we, as an older generation, used to a kind of notion of civility. You know, people say things onto the internet, which if you said them to somebody's face, you'd punch them in the face, whoever you were, even if you weren't the Pope. And they weren't talking about your mother, you would, and so on. And nevertheless, you feel a kind of degradation of the public sphere. And I'm not saying that's not unimportant, but you can get used to it, because actually, people who are going to do you violence don't send you a tweet saying they're going to do it, and so on.
I'm going to stop you there, because I think we have a couple more questions before we finish. Yep.
Thank you very much. I think it's the polite thing to say, but I'm not actually sure that I believe, thank you, after the darkness of what we've heard. My question is a couple of levels. I want to know, what do we do now? I'm a school principal of a boarding and day school. I believe we teach reading, writing and arithmetic and respect, because we have boys from all over the world, and boys from Germany, boys from the Middle East, boys from China, boys from America, boys from Ireland and the UK, and we have to live together and get on together, and we teach tolerance and respect. What do we do now as liberals to respond so that the potential situation that you describe doesn't arise. Mm. How do we develop respect better in society?
Mm. Well, I think what you're doing is definitely the right thing. It's definitely going into the right direction, teaching respect and tolerance. I think education is an important barrier to any kind of extremism. In the political sphere, it is much more difficult to give you a specific answer because, again, I'm perhaps being very pessimistic, but I think that the major political parties across Europe are moving towards what you might call the Austrian situation, where the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats have for a very long time chosen to basically ostracize and ignore the far right, FPÖ. Now, in the current presidential elections, neither of these two big parties made it to the second round. Whatever happens in the second round of the presidential election, it is already pretty much guaranteed that they will enter government, the FPÖ. And that might actually do the same trick as Syriza entering government in Greece, because they actually have to find real solutions to real problems rather than just being propagandistic. But whether it requires to include these populist movements into government in order to disenchant them, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, that has worked in the past, but still, I'd rather not live in a country that is ruled by the FPÖ for 4 years, which actually includes politicians that I would describe as neo-Nazis.
I mean, you really do feel like, don't you, going to Corinthia or somebody like that, to see standing underneath an FPÖ poster and saying to the passers-by, well, that worked for you last time, didn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that was really, that really worked. It worked for you so well that you now won't refer to the period between 1938 and 1945. You blame it all on the Germans and so on, except in certain cities like Graz, where they do come up very much up front. And that's part of it, of course, which is being very robust about the memory and very robust about the past, and very robust about the sort of values which you're teaching in your school. I mean, this is part, as I said, liberals have become apologetic. So let's stop apologising. Let's say, you know, your populist ideas, they're rubbish. They won't work, and actually they'll set people against each other, and in fact you wouldn't like to live under them, and nor do I.
So let us know when we can join up your new political party. We have one last question here. Yep.
I defy you to be more liberal than me. I'm a super liberal too. But I think one's got to acknowledge that there's a sort of an intolerance in liberalism as well. And that a lot of those people who voted Brexit for all sorts of different reasons were in some respect sort of fed up with the famous political correctness gone mad, with a sense that there is absolutely only one way of seeing the world. And that world is dictated by, yes, the media, yes, the academic classes, yes, the media classes and the political classes, and that if they step one foot out of line, you know, and express a vaguely illiberal view, they are somehow offended.
Such as Ivo.
But I think there are a lot of people who felt like that, that they feel that there's a comfortable Notting Hill elite ruling them, and I think the phenomenon of it is partly to do with the decrease in social mobility, that people feel that a certain class has got hold of all the goods of globalization, of all the benefits of it. I find it very odd because I have a broken down farmhouse in the country, which is a totally white part of Exmoor, and that was completely Brexit. And the other half of my life is in London. 40% of the population were not born in the UK, and that was totally Remain. And I think there is a sort of there's a sense of people, I think, feeling that there is a set way of thinking. It is dictated by our masters up there in London, and if we don't conform to it fully, we're left out. And I think we're going to have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, but I think surely, if I can just intervene before you two do, one of the liberal values is that you should respect free speech and argument and difference. And you know, if we try and insist, I speak as a liberal as well, on a conformity, then we're actually betraying the values for which we stand. Yeah. David, and then I'll give you the last word, Robert. So, David.
No, I mean, the trouble is that if somebody were to say, for instance, you are automatically illiberal for voting to leave the EU, that's a ridiculous thing to argue. There are plenty of good liberals who voted to leave the EU. You can disagree about that sort of thing and so on. I might be inclined to point out to them some of the disadvantages for liberalism in doing so, but nevertheless, in other words, liberalism is not about creating unnecessary divisions where they don't necessarily exist between peoples and so on. Nevertheless, to take another example that you talked about, people don't like being told they can't say X, Y, and Z. Well, I chair a freedom of organisation, freedom of expression organisation called Index on Censorship. So I'm all in favour of everybody being able to express everything. But that's not what you really mean. What you mean is, can you say that black people are lazier than white people? That's what you mean. Can you say that Jews are a bit tighter with money than the rest? I mean, isn't it a bit... Don't you get a bit fed up when you can't just make that joke about how you kill a Jew by throwing a penny under a bus? Isn't that a bit kind of, you know, in the old days you used to be able to say stuff like that? Well, I'm in favour of calling that what it is. And if that pisses you off, get pissed off. I'm not stopping you from saying it. I'm simply pointing out that if you say, I think black people are a bit lazier than white people, this is not some kind of fantastic observation that you have made from the statistics and the data, etc. It's a bit of horrible little prejudice that you've carried around in your head, and I've got every right to tell you it is. And incidentally, one of the things that I feel very strongly about in the case of Donald Trump is that one of the absolute... things animating a section of Donald Trump's campaign is white guys who are fed up not being able to call black people nigger, essentially. Yep. They really, it really is actually part of what animates them. Yep. In other words, the kind of feeling of however low we were in the pecking order, we were always above them, and we're not automatically above them anymore.
Yep. Well, if we get on to Donald Trump, we'll be here for another hour, I think. but thank you. And Robert, would you like the last word?
Yeah, I mean, in response to your question, I think that the Remain campaign, as I said before, I mean, it was foolish to focus exclusively, almost exclusively, or that's how it was perceived in the Republic, exclusively focused on how Britain would fall off an economic cliff if Brexit was to happen. Instead... I would argue they should have engaged with some of the arguments. You know, this is not a referendum about political correctness. This is not a referendum about immigration from non-European countries where black people come from. This is about a supranational project. There are certain guarantees about the level of Britain's integration within that supranational project. But very little of that actually happened. So, again, this is perhaps a weakness of liberals, that they were not defensive enough of what had been achieved. And perhaps that is also a lesson that could be learned from the 1920s and 1930s, where, again, the liberal centre was squeezed out by the extremist left and the extremist right. Now, which lessons we learn from that, I think I leave that to you. But I think we need to be a lot more positive about the achievements of liberalism since 1945, which have transformed Europe from a battlefield to the most prosperous and stable place on the planet. And we are currently in the process of unraveling that. Why? Was Europe in the 1990s really such a bad place?
Mm. Well, that's a wonderful question on which to end, and a moderately positive note. I think we've come round from, I think, considerable gloom to thinking maybe there are things that can be done. I'd like to ask you all to join me in thanking our two wonderful speakers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.